If I was Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Catalonia's president, Carles Puigdemont, Tuesday proclaimed he had a mandate to declare independence following an October 1st referendum, but stunned supporters when he called for a suspension of that declaration to undertake talks with Madrid.
La mateixa solemnitat, el govern I jo mateix,
he said the moment requires an easing of tensions, but also a clear compromise. The Catalan leader signed a document proclaiming full sovereignty. Puigdemont has been under intense international pressure to avoid an independence declaration, which Madrid has called illegal. Spain's deputy prime minister, Soraya Sáenz de Santa Maria, accused Puigdemont of creating tension and uncertainty. She said any talks must take place within the law. The Spanish government is set to meet Wednesday to discuss its next course of action. Atlantic Council Spanish analyst Carles Castillo said the Catalan leader appeared to sow confusion among his supporters.
What we've seen today was definitely disappointing for the pro-independence movement. There were thousands of people in Barcelona awaiting the declaration of independence, and once he mentioned the suspension, a lot of people just went home and accused the president of treason.
More than 40% of Catalans took part in this month's referendum, 90% voting for independence. Vote counting underway following Liberia's presidential election to replace incumbent Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first peaceful democratic transfer of power in more than seven decades. Edwina Jerome took part.
I'm looking for a leader that is transparent, a leader that will seek the interests of the people, in that a leader that will improve the education system.
No clear winner expected to emerge from 20 candidates contesting in the first round. A second round is scheduled in Liberia for November. This is VOA News. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has blamed U.S. Ambassador Robert Baz for a bilateral dispute involving a mutual suspension of visa services in the wake of the arrest of two Turkish U.S. consulate employees with alleged links to last year's failed coup. Mr. Erdogan said if Baz acted alone, he should no longer be posted to Ankara. In Washington, U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauer defended the ambassador, saying he has the full backing of the U.S. government and expressed puzzlement at Turkey's actions.
We have not seen any evidence that indicates that our staff members were involved with what the government is accusing them of doing. I just want to make that clear.
The dispute comes as the NATO allies are at odds over the fate of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen amid Turkish demands he be extradited for allegedly orchestrating that coup, and U.S. backing of Kurdish rebels in Syria. President Donald Trump is expected to make his decision public this week on Iran policy, including whether or not to decertify Iran's compliance with the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a White House spokesperson.
The president's reached a decision on a overall Iran strategy, wants to make sure that we have a broad policy to deal with that, not just one part of it, as I said last week, to deal with all of the problems of Iran being a bad actor. Beyond that, I don't have anything to add.
Mr. Trump may also announce whether he considers the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization. The UN Security Council has endorsed an action plan to break the political stalemate that's produced chaos in Libya. The Council gave its unanimous backing to a proposal by UN Special Envoy Ghassan Salame for a Libyan-led transition process. He's called for presidential and parliamentary elections next July. On the eve of a fourth round of talks on renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, U.S. and Mexican business leaders warned Tuesday the talks could collapse because of demands by the Trump administration. The head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce warned against what he called poison pill proposals, including tightening rules of origin and scrapping a dispute resolution mechanism. The International Monetary Fund has upgraded its global economic growth forecast for this year to 3.6% and 3.7% next year. In New York, the benchmark Dow Jones Index reached another record high close after global chain Walmart forecasted a spike in online sales. Syrians reeling under more than 6 years of conflict expressed widespread disappointment Tuesday as their hopes for qualifying for the country's first-ever World Cup appearance were dashed in an extra-time loss to Australia 2-1. Meanwhile, the U.S. was also eliminated from World Cup competition in Russia with a loss Tuesday to Trinidad and Tobago 2-1. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting Tuesday's Liberia presidential election is underway as the election chief answers minor complaints about the process.
There have been some reports that some voters have not been able to be located on a printed voter register. There is nothing absolutely wrong with the voter register. One of the issues was caused by voters joining the queue without consulting the queue controller.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of Liberia's Elections Commission. Kenya's opposition leader polls out of October 26th presidential election rerun. Burundi's UPRONA political party remains divided 2 years after the 2015 controversial elections. And today is the International Day of the Girl Child.
This report found that 7.5 million girls globally are married under the age of 18 every year. And the regions of the world with the highest rates of child marriage are West and Central Africa and the Middle East.
Caroline Miles is president and CEO of Save the Children. A commission of inquiry finds former Gambian president Yahya Jammeh stole millions of dollars from the country. And South Sudan refugees protest the reduction of their food rations. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting in Tuesday's Liberia presidential and parliamentary election is underway after a day of voting characterized by the Elections Commission as peaceful, with huge turnout and some minor problems, including delays at some polling stations. Final results are expected by October 25th. These voters talked about their experiences during yesterday's voting and the importance of the elections.
Since the morning started, the process is going smoothly. People are turning out in numbers. This is a free, fair, and transparent process. A lot of people turned out comparatively, the younger people and the older people. They are competing, as I can say.
Oh, I'm Sir Clinton. I voted this morning, and I mean, everything was fine. Although the process of getting to the center, I had a little problem with it because some of us that are not later started feeling discouraged and leaving the center. But as God could have it, and many of us around has knowledge to what's going on, we decided to consultize our colleagues, calling them on the side to read the ID number, and how some of them found it very smooth.
I'm Wilfred Quia. We are at the crossroad, and today we'll decide where we stand. I voted for peace and tranquility. I voted for the future of my children and children unborn.
People say there are some irregularities. The system seems very complicated. Yeah, you share that also.
You see us sitting, we try to help our first-time voters and our Liberian brothers and sisters. And this list you are looking at, we are trying to verify the number and the polling places because there have been a lot of confusion in this fence.
Calvin Collette, and I'm a queue controller. The mobile phone is like Netpolo assistant where the 1847 system will send it to either of this company in order to get the voter information. But I tried doing it, it being a little bit complicated, so I tried using the net directly, net website. So it makes it much easier when as soon as I enter the person identification number, all the person information appear, so it makes it much easier for the people to get to their voting site.
My name is Renan T. Pokolo. I'm from Moravia, Liberia. This election means a lot to me. And not even me, but for the whole Liberian and whole Liberia, it means a lot for us. Because whatever decision you take today, it's a decision that you will take for the past 6 years until you can recover your decision. So the only thing I can tell our fellow Liberians, every decision you're about to take today, I beg every one of us to take it wisely and think wisely to take it. That there will be no confusion, no fight, and our decision will come into good result. I'm happy to cash my vote for the person I want.
The voices of some Liberians during yesterday's presidential and parliamentary election. They spoke with Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Jerome Kokoya, chair of the National Elections Commission of Liberia, addressed the media yesterday about complaints of voters not being able to find their names in the printed voter register.
The majority of polling places open on time. There have been some reports that some voters have not been able to be located on a printed voter register. There is nothing absolutely wrong with the voter register, and there are a couple of reasons for this incident. One of the issues was caused by voters joining the queue without consulting the queue controller, and going straight to the polling place without checking they are in the right place in the polling precinct. The second issue was in cases where the voter is registered more than twice or twice, these individuals are registered at the last place of registration in line with our policy. You will not be at the original place if you fall inside a category. But what is happening is that the rule is that you vote where you register. And a lot of people, during the registration period, everybody for that matter, register in the particular room of the building. And during the election, that building, that place is turned into several centers. And so most of the people go, because they're supposed to vote where they register, they take it literally, they appear in that particular room. And at the end of the day, sometimes their names are in the next room, which is another center, in the same vicinity. If you are in the queue by 1800 hours, you will be allowed to vote. Until you have voted, these places will remain open. If you have been to vote earlier and could not vote, go back and make sure you follow these steps.
That was Jerome Kokoya, chair of Liberia's Elections Commission, addressing the media yesterday. Kenya's opposition leader, Raila Odinga, says he is pulling out of the October 26 rerun presidential polls, citing grievances with the Electoral Commission and President Uhuru Kenyatta's ruling party. Meanwhile, the country waits to find out what happens next in the election saga that has been going on since before the original August 8th polls. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
The electoral drama continues in Kenya after opposition leader Raila Odinga announced Tuesday that he and his NASA coalition would not be participating in the country's presidential polls later this month.
We've come to the conclusion that there's no intention on the part of the IEBC to undertake any changes to its operations and personnel to ensure that the illegalities and irregularities that led to the invalidation of the 8th August 2017 do not happen again. All indications are that the election scheduled for 26th of October will be worse than the previous one.
Odinga accused the country's electoral commission, known as the IEBC, of having no intention to streamline the electoral system to accord with the constitution and electoral laws. He also placed blame upon Kenyatta's administration for proposing amendments to electoral law that he said go against international best practice, that in the middle of an elections contest, one cannot change the rules and put in place rules that seek to favor him. In response, while speaking to supporters during a campaign rally in Kenya's coast region Tuesday, Kenyatta said he hoped there would be an election on October 26th.
And the people of Kenya will have the right to choose and determine who their leader shall be.
Odinga's team claims its withdrawal requires the IEBC to cancel the election and conduct fresh nominations, which should take place at least 90 days before a general election. The IEBC released a statement that following the withdrawal of the NASA presidential candidate, the commission and the legal team are meeting and will communicate the way forward. But that way forward is becoming more and more murky for Kenyans, as they can only guess what will happen next. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Today's Wednesday, October 11th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout-out to listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia, Radio Banga, FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, and Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Burundi's UPRONA political party remains divided 2 years after the 2015 controversial elections. The party ruled the country for 27 consecutive years. Moses Avia-Rimana reports from Bujumbura on the fate of the UPRONA party.
It's a political party in Burundi famously recognized for its role in gaining Burundian independence in 1962. After the party founder of the Burundian national hero, Louis Rwagasore, was assassinated for his lead on the country's independence. UPRONA party ruled the country for 27 years in a row, as majority of the members were from the Tutsi ethnic minority. In 2015, internal rift in the party was exposed, forcing the formation of the two factions, but only one was recognized by the Burundi government. Abel Gashasi is the chairman of the UPRONA party, the faction that is recognized by the Burundian government.
We are trying to put the member of UPRONA together. It is a work which we are doing. In the UPRONA party, the door is open. We are ready to receive those person. So in time, we are ready to talk with them.
In 2015, opposition members accused the faction that is recognized by the government of being sympathetic to the Burundian ruling party CNDD-FDD. Tassian Sibomana, the spokesman of the UPRONA party faction that is not recognized by the Burundi government, said that possible reunion can only be a reality if the other faction returns to the UPRONA vision of unity, justice and development.
That faction, which is with the system, CNDD-FDD, we are not on the same line, we are not on the same vision. If they are free, or if they are convinced that reuniting the UPRONA party is very important for all members and also for all the country, they have to let the vision of the CNDD-FDD and to return back to the vision and the ideology of the UPRONA party.
According to the leaders of the party, internal division started in 1998 after President Pierre Buyoya agreed to negotiate with the current ruling party CNDD-FDD. Tassia Sibomana says that the replacing Rwagasore was the main challenge of the party until now.
The leadership of UPRONA has no vision, no ideology like that Rwagasore. To me, that historically, we had a lot of problems about a good leader after the death of Rwagasore.
This Friday, Burundi will be marking 56 years after the assassination of Louis Rwagasore, who fought for the country's independence. UPRONA won a clear victory in elections for the colony's legislative assembly in 1961, while Gasore was declared a prime minister with a mandate to prepare for independence, but was assassinated before the country gained independence. UPRONA leaders say Belgium may have played a significant role in the assassination, although no official inquiry has ever been carried out. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In the Gambia, a commission of inquiry investigating the financial activities of exiled leader Yahya Jammeh and his government has found that Mr. Jammeh used the country's telecommunication gateway to allegedly steal millions from the country. A Lebanese business tycoon, Mohamed Bazzi, told the Jammeh Commission on Monday that he facilitated the transfer of millions of dollars into the former president's account via a Lebanon-based company. Pandere Umbai reports.
The former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh has been named in a major corruption scandal involving millions of dollars. Mr. Jammeh has been using Gambia's international telecommunication gateway for personal enrichment. Over $10 million have been paid to Jammeh's bank account by a Lebanon-based company that was contracted to manage Gambia's gateway. The main man who was coordinating the backroom deals between Jammeh and the Lebanon-based telecommunication company is Mr. Mohamed Bassi. Mr. Bassi is the owner of the Euro-Africa Group company based in the Gambia. The lead counsel attached to the Jammeh Commission, Amit Bensouda, had a showdown with Mr. Bassi over the millions of dollars that were paid into Mr. Jammeh's account through fraudulent means.
Mr. Bassi, my question is a straightforward one. What was the purpose of this money? Was it just an incentive to the president?
The president asked Mr. Sharara to give him 500,000 every month.
For what?
From his own profit or loan or whatever from the gateway.
So it was an incentive? Maybe. Or it was his share?
Not share, no. There was Mr. Sharara don't want to pay this and he was having big problem.
Mr. Bassi vehemently denied that Jammeh was bribed to contract the Lebanese company called TEL to manage the nation's gateway. He admitted that both him and Mr. Ali Sarara were under pressure from Jammeh to make a monthly $500,000 payment into Jammeh's bank account. Counsel Ami Bensouda again.
Looking at these statements and even your own summary, I note that from the 30th June 2011 to the 29th of September 2011, you paid $2 million to the Dallas account, the equivalent of $2 million into the Dallas accounts of the ex-president, without having received any money at all from TEL.
Mr. Bassey agrees with Counsel Bensouda.
That's true, because sometimes, as I explained to you, Mr. Sharara was having some financial difficulty, and he don't want even to participate after long argument about this is coming from him. So we was to make this problem solve, we was paying in advance.
Mr. Bassey's Euro Africa Group company was the main importer of fuel in the Gambia during Jammeh's rule. His co-business partner, Amadou Samba, owns 45% of the shares of the company. In another development, Mr. Njoguba, a former Secretary General and Presidential Affairs Minister under Jammeh's rule, on Tuesday said a cash amount of $500,000 was taken from the pensioners' funds and the Social Security to compensate the families of Ghanaians whose loved ones were killed in the Gambia in 2005. The Ghanaian sailors were mistaken as rebels planning to overthrow Mr. Jammeh's government. Mr. Bass said the money was hand-delivered to an emissary of the Ghanaian government in the presence of State House staffers. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pande Rimbai reporting.
Today is the International Day of the Girl. In 2011, the UN General Assembly declared October 11 as the International Day of the Girl Child to recognize girls' rights and the unique challenges they face around the world. The United Nations says in humanitarian emergencies, gender-based violence often increases, subjecting girls to sexual and physical violence, child marriage, and exploitation and trafficking. The group Save the Children and the World Bank have just released a report in which they say more than 20,000 girls are married every day below the minimum age permitted by international law. Carolyn Miles, president and CEO of Save the Children, says the rates of child marriage are particularly highest in West and Central Africa.
Well, we found that globally, this report that we did with the World Bank found that 100 million girls are susceptible to early marriage, and about 7.5 million girls globally are married under the age of 18 every year. And the areas, the regions of the world with the highest rates of child marriage are West and Central Africa and the Middle East.
What do you think accounts for these marriages that you mentioned, and how can this practice particularly be stopped in Africa?
Yes, well, in some cases, it really is because of laws. So I'll give you an example. In Niger, the legal age of marriage for boys is 18, but it's for girls it's 15. So changing those laws and making the age of marriage 18 for both girls and boys is one way to change things. But it's also, it's not just about laws. We find that it's also about changing beliefs or customs. And a lot of times the accepted custom is that a girl will become married at 13 or 14, and that's very much accepted in the society. So
that's exactly, and I thought maybe I should ask that question to you. What do you say to those people who might say that this practice is widely accepted, in, as you mentioned, in other parts of Africa, because it has some traditional and religious roots?
That's right. And we certainly honor those kinds of roots and religion, but we think that when it comes to girls and their well-being, this is not a good practice. And when a girl gets married early, she almost always drops out of school, so her education is ended. She'll likely have a child within a year. She is more susceptible to dying during childbirth. That child is more susceptible to dying. That family is likely to be, and that woman is likely to be living in poverty, and that cycle of poverty starts again. So we know it's not in the best interest of girls. And so that's really what we're trying to convince and talk to families. And as I said, those who have influence on families, leaders, global leaders, government leaders, and tribal leaders, that this is not in the best interest of girls.
A conference is coming up later this month in Senegal, and African countries are involved in that. It's about ending child marriage. What do you hope should come out of this conference in terms of how to end child marriages?
Well, that's right. This conference, and it's African-led. The First Lady of Sierra Leone, for example, is one of the leaders of the meeting. And we think it's going to be really important in changing things, you know, certainly bringing more international attention to the issue of early marriage, but also convincing governments who are there to make sure that they do have the laws and they uphold the laws that are putting that legal age of marriage at least 18. We think that's very important. And then starting to talk about ways that we change these beliefs and these customs.
Carolyn Miles is president and CEO of Save the Children. She was speaking with me from New York. South Sudanese refugees protesting the reduction of their food ration this month say the decision by the World Food Program is forcing them to adopt difficult coping plans. But a World Food Program official says the measure was triggered by a delay in the delivery of food supplies and is only temporary. Simon Peter Apiku has more from Adjumani in northern Uganda.
The World Food Programme says it had no option but to cut in half the monthly ration of 12 kilograms of cereals for refugees in Uganda's West Nile region. The UN Food Agency says to minimize the impact of the food cut, WFP is giving cash to refugees so that they can buy their own cereals from nearby markets. South Sudanese refugees at the Agodzo camp in Adjumani district, like Jane Keji, a mother of four, says the cut hurts families, particularly children and lactating mothers. Keji says buying cereals in the market is not as easy as it sounds because of the scarcity of food supplies.
Since they cannot get for us food and they have given for us cash, where do they expect us to get the food?
Sam Manduga, a father of seven and a leader of one of the blocks in the Agodzo camp, says most families in the settlement have run out of food.
The food which is we have received, 6 kilo, it has taken now 2 weeks ago. Now when you reach in each family household, you will not get food automatically.
The WFP says because it had enough cash on hand, it decided in conjunction with its partners that it would be best to provide refugees with half the normal ration of cereals and 7,000 Ugandan shillings to each refugee to buy what they need from the market. South Sudanese refugee Muroga Abraham says he likes the idea of receiving cash but argues that transportation costs to and from the market cuts down on the amount he can spend on food.
You go a distance to look for the food. As a result, from Agodzo, I went up to Siforo to look for food. I could not get. Then from Siforo, I tried to travel up to Adjumani, Awintiri, to get the food. And then I bought the food there. The transport cost is also on me.
Keji says mothers like her are forced to either cut the number of meals they eat per day or reduce the quantity of food consumed. The UN Food Agency's country director, Al-Khidr Dalloum, says WFP is facing delays in funding and other UN bureaucratic problems.
Whenever the funding delay, and especially if it's dependent on regional recruitment or international recruitment, it means the time of the recruitment to the delivery is going to be delayed. And that will affect the physical amount of food to be provided for the refugees.
The WFP now offers refugees the option to choose between receiving food or cash. If refugees prefer direct food assistance instead of cash, that's what they'll get, according to Dalloum. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Pico in Adjumani.
And that's it for this Wednesday, October 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Button, Washington, saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the Grace Hopper celebration. The conference is the world's largest gathering of women in technology. We'll recap the events in Orlando, Florida, and speak with African women working in the industry in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere for their perspective on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.